The joint House and Senate Judiciary Committee meeting will come to order. Present at the table today are Senators Huggins, Senator Wilikowski, and Senator French, myself. I want to begin by apologizing on behalf of my House colleagues, who I know wanted to be here, had scheduled time to be here, but through an unavoidable clash of the calendars, find themselves in session right now debating bills. So I'm certain they will be arriving as soon as their time permits, but I did not want to make these good members of the commission wait any longer, because I know you all have busy schedules. You're here to make a presentation. We've all received a report, and so without any further introduction, I'll turn it over to the Attorney General designee. You can introduce the fine people that are with you, and please begin.
Thank you, Chairman French, Senator Wilikowski, and Senator Huggins. Appreciate your time, and as the saying goes, life is kind of like a box of chocolates. You never know what you get, and one of the benefits of being designee Attorney General is that I get to be automatically co-chair of the Alaska Rural Justice and Law Enforcement Commission, which is why we're here before you today. And sitting at the table with me today are Loretta Bullard and Jim Torgerson, who have been on this commission considerably longer than me. I'm, as you know, very new to this particular job and its secondary positions. Sitting behind us is also on our commission is former Attorney General Bruce Botello, our Executive Director Karen Bitzer, and I believe for the commission that's who is present with us today. And so we have a PowerPoint that we were going to present to you, and I'd like to just lead into that if that's okay with you, and we'll trade off amongst us as to who speaks to which items are on the presentation before you.
Please proceed.
Thank you. We are reporting to you, this is a federal body that's created as the we're going to present the history, the commission's membership, which I believe, Senator French, you asked a little bit about. We'll try to address your questions there. The process that we are operating under, the recommendation highlights our future, and then we have question and answer session if you so choose at the end. This commission was created in 2004 by the federal government, and we are in theory appointed by the Attorney General of the United States, although some of the positions are designated as to who he will appoint. For example, my position would be he appoints the Attorney General of the State of Alaska, or the Attorney General designee in this case. The appointments I'll go through the actual membership shortly, but we are also charged with four broad areas of investigation and to trying to address persistent problems that faced Alaska in regard to law enforcement in terms of rural areas, judicial systems that are presented by the complexity of our state and its unique history in terms of having something slightly different than the traditional state relationship with native peoples, the alcohol importation and interdiction problems that plague parts of our state, and how to address the system that we have, where we have some dry and intermediate levels of government over certain types of alcohol allowances in certain areas, and domestic violence and child abuse, and the disproportionate demographic numbers that again need to be addressed in some form, and we try to move in that direction with this commission. The actual membership is complete. There are no vacancies on the commission as we are having this meeting today. Not everyone could be here today, but that doesn't mean there isn't a full commission in place. The federal co-chair, my counterpart, is the Attorney General for Alaska, the District Attorney General for Alaska, Mr. Nelson Cohen, who is not here with us today. Mr. Botello represents the Alaska Municipal League. Patrick Anderson would represent the Alaska Federation of Natives. Wilson Justin, who may come to the meeting, his flight has been delayed, would be the tribal representative, a nonprofit Native Corporation representative is Loretta Bullard, who is sitting to my left. The Commissioner of Public Safety, Mr. Walt Monaghan, is also new to the commission, and just like me, he's a cabinet position. Alaska Native Justice Center, Gail Schubert, I think was going to be here. I'm Is she in town?
She's in town.
Yeah. I don't think she's in the room right now. The non-voting federal court representative is the gentleman to my right, Mr. Torgerson, and an organized borough representative would be Charlotte Brower, and then special assistant or executive director in some terminology would be Karen Bitzer. And with that, Mr. Torgerson, I will address the process which he's been involved in from the very inception of the committee, I believe. So.
I'm going to slide this a little bit closer here. Thank you for inviting us to address you today. And thank you also to Attorney General Kohlberg and Commissioner Monaghan, who, despite the fact that they obviously have very full plates as they come to their new positions, have made time for all of our meetings and have been working very quickly to become involved with and are very involved with the Commission. We very much appreciate the attention that both of them have given to the Commission. I am going to talk about process, often a scintillating subject, so I'm sure I will do my best to try to make it interesting. And then Loretta is going to talk about the recommendations of the Commission. And then I think that Attorney General Kohlberg will come back and talk about some of the issues that may result in proposals for new legislation toward the end of the presentation. You can see a calendar of meetings and working groups and so on the slide, so I won't belabor that. But there are a couple points regarding our process that I think are worth talking about. One is that very early on, back in October of 2004, we spent a fair amount of time talking about the protocols that were going to govern the way in which we work together. And part of that was talking about votes and how the votes are going to be handled and whether you needed to have a majority and so on and so forth. At some point fairly early on in our actual process of working together, that formality was abandoned. We still do take votes, but we moved towards a consensus model of decision making. And the reason for that, I think, is at least in part because we don't have the authority to require anybody to do anything. So if all of the individuals involved in this process don't support it, we're not going to accomplish anything. So we work through consensus, which imposes a couple of disciplines on us. First of all, it affects what we choose to do. There are issues that parties are not going to agree on. There are jurisdictional questions that are important in rural Alaska that the stakeholders in this process aren't going to agree on in a consensus process for good reasons, and so we don't deal with those by and large. So we look for issues that we think parties can agree on, look for places where we can agree and move forward. And then we've also approached how we go about trying to find solutions with that same need in mind. That is, we need to move to consensus. So we'll talk about work groups in a bit, but one thing we do in putting together the work groups is trying to make sure that all the stakeholders are involved so that all the divergent views will be at the table when we're working through issues, kind of a robust conversation, and make sure that at the end we've got something that everybody can agree to. So first of all, consensus has been our model, and we've, as a result of that, worked mostly to be a convener and then later an advocate. A convener in terms of bringing together these disparate stakeholders, and then once they've come up with recommendations that the Commission has had a chance to review and adopt or not, then become an advocate for implementing what those recommendations might be. I think there...
Could I just jump in there, because I was, if I could just ask a question about that convening. Where do those events happen, and who is invited, and what's the duration of them? I mean, are these quarterly events? Are they semi-annual? Do you have conferences? What? Maybe you can just give me a little flavor of how those work. If that's in your presentation, then I'll skip over
it. It is, but I could talk to it now, and then we can just go over it faster later. Yeah, the Commission itself has been on a schedule of meeting more or less monthly over the last about 9 months. There was a time there where we didn't have Ms. Bitzer working with us, and so we weren't meeting quite as regularly. But then we started meeting more regularly, about monthly. And we've had two sets of working groups. We had one set of working groups back in January through April of 2005, and then another set last fall. Both times we pulled together four different working groups and gave them a specific subject to work on. Now, the first time around, the subjects were pretty broad. The second time, they were narrower. And both times, we started that process by having face-to-face meetings in Anchorage. Usually, I think they're a couple days in duration. May have been only one day this last time. And then that was followed up by weekly teleconferences of all the members for a period of 3-4 months or so. And then we had meetings, everybody face-to-face again at the end. I think both times we also had an sort of halfway through face-to-face meeting, in part because, especially on difficult issues, it sometimes is a lot more effective to have people actually sitting across the table from each other rather than being on telephones or doing things by email. So generally, in both instances, the duration has been several months. It's been a mixture of face-to-face meetings and teleconferences. And the membership has been suggested by, I think there's probably a multi-step process. There's sort of a polling process. Ms. Bitzer would talk to the stakeholders about who they think should be on the work groups. Recommendations would be made, then ultimately those would come before the commission, and the commission would approve the composition of the work group. Again, with a mind towards what's the issue, who has expertise about these issues, who has strong feelings about these issues, and how do we make sure we get all the right people involved in the process. So, yeah. So back to the commission, I think that it's fair to break our work into sort of three different parts. One part is listening, the second is brainstorming, and then the third is implementing. The listening shows up on the calendar there, the public hearings that we had. It says January to May 2005. We actually started them in October of 2004 and went through May of 2005. That was taking testimony around the state. I think we had 10 or 11 hearings around the state where we heard from members of the public. Most of those hearings were in rural areas. As you can imagine, much of the testimony was very heartfelt. People have real concerns that they really want help addressing. And then we went from that into the work group session, which is what I'm going to refer to as a brainstorming, where we bring people together and say, okay, help us come up with some new ideas here, and then move into the implementation step after that, which is, okay, which of these ideas do we push forward, and how do we do that? For your information, I think that we're in the implementation stretch right now because we just finished another round of work group meetings. We've got a bunch of recommendations that we're sorting through and are trying to advance forward on. You'll also hear probably a little bit later that we're right now slated to run out of money in 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks. So we're looking for more resources so we can actually go forward and implement, but that's something we can come back to later. Okay, so that's an overview of the process. I've been trusted with running the PowerPoint here, which is probably the most challenging part of the whole thing, but hopefully we'll make it. Like I said, two different sets of work groups. The first set, got over 100 options from the work groups. We looked through them all. We organized them into 9 general categories or 9 general themes. We didn't have time to actually prioritize them, but we did want to try to make some sense of them, and so we've got these 9 general categories, and that's what Ms. Bullard will walk through with you a bit later. The second...
one, please, Senator Huggins.
That's what's in the back of this book.
That's right, yeah.
Long list
yeah.
of recommendations.
Yes. That's a question I should address in a bit more detail. This was just published in, I think, December of this year, but it was actually completed in terms of the written work much earlier than that. And so it does not reflect the work that was done by the work groups last fall. It just reflects the work that was done a year ago. And so it has all 100 options, and it's got the 9 thematic categories in the organization. So
just for clarity's sake, were these recommendations further winnowed by the working group, or do these remain as the proposals, if you will, of the commission?
The recommendations that are contained in here are the recommendations that the commission took from the working groups and adopted.
Okay.
So there were other options that came from the working groups that the commission looked at and for whatever reason decided not to adopt. But if they're called a recommendation, then it's something that the commission has adopted.
Thank you.
And then this time around, with a second group of working groups, we tried to narrow our focus some more. and go from 100-plus recommendations to a few more specific areas that we wanted to try to develop a bit more. And the four that we focused on were developing a tiered system of law enforcement, seeing if we could develop a model Indian Child Welfare Act Memorandum of Understanding, exploring whether there were ways that we could use new technologies to better provide law enforcement and judicial services in rural Alaska, and alcohol interdiction. I'll say a little bit more about each of those four, and then I think Loretta will follow up with more detail as well. Developing a tiered system of law enforcement is an idea that came from a work group that was made up of people who were combatants at the time in litigation about the provision of law enforcement services in rural Alaska. And that group was able to recognize that whatever differences they might have, it was important to have better law enforcement services in rural Alaska. So they put forward this idea of a tiered system, and then a work group last fall worked on trying to flesh that out a bit more. And we were very fortunate that at that time Walt Monaghan, now Commissioner Monaghan, was the facilitator for the work group, and so he was very involved in the incubation of this idea, and I think from listening to him that he's quite enthused about trying to push forward with it. And like I said, Ms. Bullard will explain a bit more about it. The model ICWA MOU involves a situation where there's federal recognition, federal law that recognizes Alaska Native villages as tribes for purposes of ICWA issues, and there's state law that authorizes the state to enter into agreements with those entities. And our goal was to try to put together the language for an agreement between the state and a tribe regarding providing services in villages. There are a lot of places in rural Alaska, obviously, where the state doesn't have a presence, doesn't have Office of Children's Services employees, and so the children who might be children in need of aid, who may be subject to abuse, who may have adoption issues in those villages, are underserviced. And so the question was, is there a way we can try to extend the provision of services to those areas despite some of the jurisdictional issues that have been an impediment? The process that we've engaged in trying to come together on a model MOU has not been completed. The working group has done most of the work. Commission hasn't had a chance to review it yet, but we've done, again, most of the work is done on one. We've just got a few issues to work through, and we're very hopeful that we'll reach resolution and something that's useful to the state and to rural communities, and then it can be a model for collaboration between the state and rural communities.
On that point, do you anticipate that that memorandum of understanding will require conforming legislation, either state or federal?
No.
So you'll fit within the framework that's already in place?
Yes. Fantastic. There are two or three issues that it may be that they can't be resolved without some conforming legislation, but at this point we're thinking that they can be, or at least we're working to see if they can be, because it's obviously easier if we can do that without conforming legislation.
Sure. Thank you.
Yeah. Technology, again, this is an issue that Ms. Bullard will flesh out, but we wanted to look at the question of, given the remoteness of so much of our statewide community, given the new technologies, are there ways to provide law enforcement services and judicial services in remote areas that are superior to what we're doing right now? And then alcohol interdiction, this is obviously the scourge of rural Alaska, alcohol is, and so we focused a lot of time on trying to come up with some additional ideas about how to deal with that. Our work group came back with 24 options for us. Just in the interdiction area, this group wasn't looking at prevention, and some of them I think you may hear about in the form of legislative proposals later, but those are the four areas that we picked out of the entire universe to focus on last year around. And there we go. And I'm going to. This is the first of the nine areas that the commission identified and grouped its recommendations into after its first go around. Hi, Representative.
Thanks for being late.
The committee would like the record to reflect that Senator Terrio joined us some 10 minutes ago, and Representative Holmes has joined us just now from the floor of the House. Thank you, and welcome, Representative Holmes.
So I'm going to speak to this first of the nine areas, and then Ms. Board will speak to the other eight. The first recommendation, first thematic recommendation, was engaging in more partnering and collaboration. We deliberately put this one first because we think that given the needs in rural Alaska and given the limited resources in rural Alaska, the most powerful thing that that we could do would be to try to find ways to encourage the entities and individuals who have an interest in meeting those needs to collaborate more and to enter into more partnerships. The one specific task that we've been working on is the one I already mentioned, which was trying to develop a model ICWA MOU, again, both because of its importance in its own right and because it could be an example of and a model for working together, which we would hope would spread into other areas. And then, well, I think the rest of the slides you can read for yourself. So I will now give way to Commissioner Bullard, who has been with the commission since its outset and is one of our rural members.
Great. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you. Recommendation two is making systemic changes to improve rural law enforcement. And I think one of the recommendations, developing a uniform tiered statewide system for certification training for peace officers. This is something that we all support. QUIRC is the regional nonprofit for the Bering Straits region, which I've served as president for, and we have the Village Public Safety Officer program for the region. But one problem that I think both the Alaska State Troopers, certainly municipal police officers, as well as folks at the local level have, is finding individuals to work in those positions. And basically the tiered program is the village police officers, APSC has their criteria for those positions, though I understand folks that are working in that field aren't meeting them currently. The VPSO standards are set by the Department of Public Safety, and then you have APSC again providing standards for the Alaska State Troopers and the municipal police officers. Right now, there's no relationship between any of those in terms of a natural progression. And what we're proposing here would set that natural progression in place so that, you know, for example, in our area, we've had four VPSOs go on to become Alaska State Troopers. And there's some wonderful individuals out there that could do that. Right now, they have to go through the academy all over again, where much of the basic training that VPSOs, municipal police officers, and Alaska State Troopers receive is all the same training. There's no connection amongst the tracking that training and providing for that natural progression.
So just to jump in on that, because that mm-hmm. does seem like one of the innovations that Commissioner Monaghan's interested in, and I think it's a real great idea, mm-hmm. for lack of a better word. And so maybe you could just spend a little time on this. The idea is to take these three sort of different titles, VPO, VPSO, and police officer, mm-hmm. or certified officer, and spread them into, I believe it's like Peace Officer 1, Peace Officer 2, Peace Officer 3. Is that mm-hmm. is that the idea?
Yes. And providing for that opportunity for upward mobility for our VPSOs and providing a kind of a labor pool, kind of a natural progression for municipal police officers as well as Alaska State Troopers.
And I'd like to welcome to the committee Chair Ramirez. Chair Ramirez, we began, of course, because I didn't want to sorry to have started without you,
Senator French.
But mm-hmm. we felt obliged to not hold up these fine members of the commission in their desire to make their presentation to us. And I see you have something you want to show the committee.
No. I just wanted to let you know I'm formidable, Senator French, but I'm delighted to be here with you.
Read that whole book, I presume.
Yes, I can define that.
And let the record reflect that Representative Linz joined us. Ms. Bullard, please, Commissioner, please continue.
Afternoon, I guess.
I was going to say, we concur, and we think it's a wonderful idea, this tiered statewide tiered system of certification and training. I think it's greatly needed and will really help address all of our recruitment problems for all of our positions out there.
I know we're still in the early phases of developing this idea, but I'm just wondering whether this would require or whether it would benefit from a restructuring of the academy process. The police academy, the trooper academy in Sitka, whether you wouldn't have a separate training module, if you will, for Peace Officer 1 and then Peace Officer 2, Peace Officer 3, that wouldn't have to repeat for each of those individuals what they'd learned in the past.
Right. And, like, for example, currently I know the VPSOs receive 602 hours when they go through the VPSO Academy. And according to Commissioner Monaghan, basically the only difference between the municipal and Alaska State Trooper training and the VPSO training that's currently provided is municipal police officers and troopers receive gun and vehicle training, which the VPSOs do not because they don't drive police cars and they don't carry guns. So that's the basic difference between the two academies.
Thank you. And the record should reflect that we've been joined by Representative Coghill. Thank you, and please proceed.
And then there's also some recommendations dealing with alcohol interdiction, a discussion of creating alcohol kind of distribution points in some of our regional centers that are wet, as well as some of the sub hubs that are wet, so that we don't have alcohol shipments just going into our wet communities without being accounted for, which then results in a lot of that alcohol going into dry communities. There was also some work that Commissioner Dandusky did regarding cross-designation of troopers and postal inspectors. There aren't enough postal inspectors in this state to help interdict drugs and alcohol that are making it into the bush. And it's all going in, for the most part, via the mail and the airplanes. We don't, have a lot of, certainly in Northwest Alaska anyway, we don't have a lot of boat traffic 9 months of the year. So that's how it's getting in. And then there's a suggestion that legislation be introduced that would ban plastic bottles shipments of alcohol to rural Alaska, so that it would have to be glass.
And explain, maybe you could explain for the members of the committee the thinking behind that, for those of us who don't maybe don't work in this area on a regular basis. Why the distinction? What criminal law enforcement advantage do you gain by insisting on glass bottles?
Can I speak to that, Jim?
The noise? The noise.
Clinks and breaks and...
So it's instead of a knock and talk, it's a shake and search, sort of a shake and break kind of an approach. Whoops, I dropped it kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. And I think plastic, personally, I think that plastic is easier to conceal. I mean, you get there's a lot of alcohol shipments, like from Nome going out to the villages that are dry, where folks are sticking those plastic bottles and boxes of detergent and this, that, and the other thing. That
they are nearly indestructible, aren't they?
Yeah.
Right.
So.
Interesting.
Next.
Yeah, I would add on that point that there are, the commission also would not necessarily recognize the difference between plastic or the importance of plastic versus glass, but that's why we try to reach out to people who are actually working in the area and talk to people in rural Alaska about what makes a difference. This is one of those suggestions that came from the law enforcement or rural Alaska community that we're really trying to get on. I told you that Ms. Bullard was going to address all of the themes, but there's one more that I was going to address, and that is this one: enlarge the use of community-based solutions. Generally, the commission believes that to the extent we can engage the local communities in providing as much self-governance and local control as possible, that's a good thing. There's some jurisdictional issues that we're not engaging with on this front because, as I said before, we look to consensus. But we do look for ways to try to provide for more community-based solutions. The one specific one that's received some focus in this go-around of work groups work is legislation, potential legislation proposing distribution centers in Bethel and Constitute. There's currently a distribution center in
Barrow.
Barrow, And I'm not the most well-informed person about this, but my understanding is that the distribution center is a means of trying to control the inflow of alcohol into the community, and there's some taxes involved, and it means to have better control of who's getting the alcohol and where it's going. And so the proposal would be to look at distribution centers in Bethlehem and Constance, again, as a way to try to have better control of the flow of alcohol into rural Alaska.
Thank you. And the record should reflect we've been joined by Representative Greenberg.
Recommendation four. Sorry.
If I might, Mr.
Chairman. Senator Huggins, please.
Not to complicate the discussion, and I support, I've read through your recommendations, but I just have to say that the tenor of this discussion is much different. We were talking about marijuana is a legal substance, and your house is your castle, and nobody should be able. And here we're talking about, you know, how we're going to keep people from doing. And it just, I'm just wondering legally where we're treading some places where we can't go. I hope we can do everything you're describing.
I think that the issue that you raised generally is a very important one, and it's one that we struggle with. There are some ideas that we've thought look really good, but we've concluded there's just no way that they're going to, there's no way they're going to be legal, and so we pull back. Some of these other ideas haven't come to you yet in the form of legislation because they're not fully mature, and it may be that before they do come before you, somebody will raise an issue that creates a problem and suggests that we can't go forward. So we are concerned about, obviously, about making sure that everything we do would withstand constitutional muster. And obviously with the Department of Law represented by the Attorney General, that's something that we expect would happen before something came before you.
I mean, I just recall in the case of marijuana, the Supreme Court had prescribed an amount of marijuana that you could have in your house that exceeded, according to some, what would be a year's supply. And you'd probably have to sell it because it'd go bad anyway. And here we're saying, you know, we're going to use, got to use glass bottles, not plastic, so we can make sure you don't have it. And it's an interesting difference in tenor based on communities. But the same law applies.
Well, there are some differences between marijuana and alcohol, obviously.
I understand. I'm just the tenor of the discussion.
The next recommendations deal with broadening the use of prevention approaches. Being a Nome, and we provide, Clorac North Sound Health Corporation provide a lot of services throughout the region, but there is a real lack of prevention education, I think, certainly in the villages, as well as services. Certainly, I think there's a need for information in our earlier grades dealing with alcohol, substance abuse, domestic violence, child abuse, respect-based values, and interpersonal relationships. I just wanted to speak to the U.S. Attorney Tim Burgess before he became a judge, traveled with myself and a number of other individuals to five of our villages, and Tim had provided information on meth. And his presentation made a huge impression on the high school students in our villages, and they hadn't received that before or seen that information before. And just kind of anecdotally, I mean, there's people that I've talked to in Nome have suggested that we're starting to get meth in Nome, and I know that it's been an issue already in Barrow, and I think there's a huge concern about meth making it into the bush and the huge impact that could have on our rural communities over and above the problems that we presently experience with alcohol. So there is a real need to, you know, put some resources there. In the Bering Straits region and throughout the state, currently in our area, 44% of our population is 18 years of age and younger. We have a huge young adult population.
44%?
44% of our population is age 18 years of age and younger. So, and I think that's pretty much the case throughout rural Alaska. You have a huge young population out there that needs to have those that education provided to them. Next. There's also the need to broaden therapeutic efforts. with the cuts in funding for both certainly federal as well as state funding for alcohol and drug abuse treatment, just using our region as an example, North Sound Health Corporation had to close their residential alcohol treatment program. They currently have an outpatient program, but a day program. So, for example, if somebody from one of our villages needs alcohol treatment, you know, they can't come to Nome and get it. They have no place to stay. There's waiting lists to get into to inpatient treatment programs, and there's just a huge need for alcohol and drug abuse treatment efforts. There's no aftercare services in the bush. We support the use of therapeutic courts. I think they have a Bethel drug court where these individuals are referred for service as opposed to necessarily incarceration. And then just the need for providing foster care for youth, perhaps in a group home setting where they're able to get the services that they need. There's also recommendations dealing with increasing employment of rural residents in law enforcement and judicial services. This morning, I think it was Commissioner Smith spoke to the fact that 33% of the individuals incarcerated in the state of Alaska are Alaska Native, which is huge when you consider that only 20% of the state's population is Alaska Native, and that there is a need to for those positions that are available within corrections to employ more Alaska Natives in those positions. And this is currently happening where the VPSOs are serving as probation officers in the villages, and that's worked very well, where the VPSOs get a salary bump because they're basically serving as the eyes and ears to make sure that individuals are not violating their probation at the village level.
On the last point, using VPSOs as probation officers, where will you take that idea next? I think that's a great idea. Who will?
That's currently happening. That's currently happening, and that was you know, I guess they're probably not, in my mind, I don't think that they're the fully trained, you know, career probation officer, but they are the eyes and ears to make sure that people are not violating their probation by consuming or violating other court orders at the local level. And when they encounter those situations, then those individuals are, you know, arrested and then brought into, for example, into Nome and charged with violating their probation or other. So I think it's great, and it's working wonderfully, I think.
It makes a lot of sense. I just wonder how the interaction is between, you know, those officers that have the authority and ability to file a petition to revoke probation, you know, whether they're proceeding on the affidavit, if you will, of the VPSO, or if they're forced to go to the village to observe the violation themselves.
I don't think they're not traveling to the villages, so I'm sure it's on the sworn affidavit of the VPSO.
Makes sense. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coghill.
You know, I also think that's a pretty good recommendation. However, just from personal experience, I can see where that runs into a little bit of a problem, and you might tell me what you've observed, and that is you get a VPSO that has those two different authorities, and you get into close family situations where somebody hired from that village is put in some very awkward family positions. Has that been discussed at all?
I think that's just a fact of life. Anytime you hire an individual from a community to serve, for example, as a VPSO, those situations or allegations always come up. And I know CORECA's employer, the VPSOs, and the Alaska State Troopers look at those very carefully to make sure that, you know, a VPSO is not being especially lenient on their family. Those allegations come up, and it's just dealt with.
There is a, Mr. Chairman, there is then a kind of an application vetting that goes through that to talk about not only professional credentialing, but where there might be those potential conflicts. Is that something you look? Is that what they're looking at? Is that what I heard you say?
I'm just saying that we look at those conflicts as they arise. It's just a fact. That's the case.
It's just that when you get a VPSO can be for the primary use eyes and ears and a quick telephone call. But a PO actually then is able to make people go to jail, you know, at their word, without a whole lot of due process, except for the fact that there's already been some due process done. But it can be a very quick issue, and I do know just from personal experience that has been a testy area, just to let you know.
You can see the area of conflict, but you can also see, I think, the area for efficiency and, you know, good law enforcement in the village and an ability to return an offender to his or her home community where that person may have a greater opportunity to flourish, yet at the same time be under the watchful eyes of a local law enforcement officer.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I was just looking kind of further down under your recommendation to see how far you'd gone into that thought process, that's all.
I hope we'll have time at the end of the presentation to go through some of the recommendations and have members ask about individual ones. I know I have some questions about them as well. But if there are no more questions on this point, please continue.
There's a whole series of recommendations dealing with building additional capacity. I think this is not only an issue for the Alaska State Troopers, but also for village public safety officers in the villages. I think initially when the VIPSO program was first started, the ideal was to hire individuals from the community, and if you do that, you don't have housing issues. Well, I know that a lot more VPSOs are being hired from outside the village as well as even out of state. And when you bring those individuals in, you have housing crunches because in many of the villages you have two or three generations living in homes, and they've been waiting for, let's say, a housing authority house for 15 years, and there is just very limited housing out there, and a lot of the housing is substandard. So that's a huge issue in rural Alaska in terms of housing for the troopers as well as the village public safety officer programs. I think the other big issue associated with that is just the state of the holding cells in the villages. We're currently doing an assessment of the holding cells in the Bering Straits region, and the conditions out there are deplorable. And I'm sure that there's liability that the city governments are incurring because they have these holding cells. They're mostly in city facilities. There may be liability that the state has also because these individuals are being arrested and housed in these facilities and then being brought into the, for example, the Anvil Mountain Correctional Center. The conditions out there are really, really deplorable, and those need to be addressed. In terms of the statewide data system, I think we'll get into that a little bit more in our next slide. So, recommending increased access to judicial services. You have certainly courts in Nome, Cots, Bethel, Barrow, and the urban areas, but beyond that, there is very little access to judicial services in the rural villages, and so we'd like to see funding made available to increase that access. I mean, for example, in Nome right now, unless you have $200 to pay a private attorney, you have no access to legal services if you need them for civil cases. Just not available. We're suggesting utilization of tribal courts in those communities that have them. They do fulfill a role where certainly in juvenile proceedings they can be addressing issues at the local level, because right now, currently, unless a juvenile does something very serious, they don't even come to the attention of the public safety. It's got to be something serious before it's addressed in the state system versus trying to be addressed at the local level.
On the issue of tribal courts, maybe you could give us some idea of where those are in operation right now and where some of the success stories are taking place, where the more efficient or well-run tribal courts are located.
I think that Cake Tribal Court was an example that was brought up during the public hearing process of the commission. I think it was in 1997 they created that CAKE Tribal Court, because at the time in CAKE they had like 17 suicides of young adults in CAKE the previous year, which CAKE is not that large of a community. And so they created CAKE Tribal Court where, you know, when they have youth or other individuals in their community who encounter problems, it's not a punitive court. It's a court whereby the various entities in that community get together with the individual, with their family, and work with them to address their issues that are leading to those problems. And at the time they had testified before the commission, they had not had a single youth suicide since that time, which is pretty amazing that in the last 10 years they haven't had a suicide in CAKE. And I just kind of compare that with our region, where I was just looking at stats recently. In the last 10 years we've had 62 suicides in the Bering Straits region. And we do have tribal courts in a number of our villages, and they do a lot of work on adoptions and children's cases and you know, placement issues and such. So they do a lot of that.
Representative Coghill.
And it is a complex area. First of all, you got to notice that a lot of communities are doing what they can to try to get what I would consider a restorative justice model in the tribal group. So my hat's off to them for that. I think that's excellent. The suicide issue, there's a whole range of issues I think that are just excellent. But we really run into a kind of a jurisprudence problem of how do you describe it legally? How do you have different sovereignties working? I'm just not a big fan of surrendering state authority to tribal governments, but I really want to figure out how to work with tribal groups when they're doing restorative justice. So I think that's one of the things that in Alaska we have to look over. The feds probably have a little different look than we do, and so when you go down through this commission, I just get really nervous. And I think the children cases is probably where it actually becomes very clear that if you have a couple tribal jurisdictions that come up with different types of conclusions, you don't have a standardized law except for ICWA, Indian Child Welfare Act, and it doesn't dovetail real good with the state law. And I've kind of wandered into that a little bit. It can get really tough. Plus, you get into sometimes a three or four edged problem. You have a state assert a certain authority, one village asserting another authority, and another village asserting a different authority. So we're going to have to work on this one. But I just think the kind of the constitutional basis of it is very difficult to describe. But we've got to find out ways, and I'm glad you're looking at it in that it's kind of a local initiative that says we got to do better with our health. So I'm willing to work in that, but I know it's going to be a tough issue to deal with, at least from my perspective.
I can let Jim speak to the ICWA MOU because I didn't participate in that process. It's just kind of on the ground in our region, and I can just speak to our region. We look at it as shared jurisdiction. And using an example, you have the Office of Children's Services office there in Nome. I think that they've got four people working there, and it's kind of a boom bust there in terms of they seem to go through regular purges. They're down to two people, they're back up to six. There's a lot of turnover down there, and actually there are individuals that used to work for us, so there's turnover down there. We have 16 communities in the Bering Straits region, of which you've got Nome, Teller, Accessible, and everybody else you have to fly to. The state does not have a presence out there. We do have what we call our tribal family service workers in every single village. And we had set up a memorandum of agreement between the state OCS, COERIC, and the tribal family service workers at the local level, where those tribal family service workers, which are funded with federal dollars, were serving as the eyes and ears for both COERIC, which has a contract with the state for case management services, as well as the eyes and ears for OCS, who can't be out there. I mean, they go out and do, you know, investigative work, but, you know, you have a lot of children that can be victimized out there that the state's not going to be aware of unless there's somebody serving as eyes and ears, or maybe determinations have been made that the child is in need of aid, and you know they'll do well, they'll do child family checks and such like that at the local level, and it works well on the ground.
Chairman, and I didn't mean to say otherwise, because that's, I applaud that effort. I think that's absolutely, that is community people coming to the rescue of their own people. So I'm grateful for that. But it works quite differently, for example, in the Tanana River Basin than it does up in the Northwest. And it works quite even more differently down in the Tok-Taslina area than it does up in the lower Yukon River. So the standardization, how we work with communities, memorandums of understanding, what those all look like, are huge issues yet to be kind of land on the ground with. Anyway, I just wanted to bring it up.
Briefly, we know that this jurisprudential issue is a big one. We also know it's one the Commission isn't going to resolve. It probably won't be resolved until the Supreme Court of the United States or Congress acts further. But we also know that the needs that Loretta just described are there. They need to be resolved. They need to be addressed. And we don't want to find ourselves in a position where nothing is being done to meet those needs until those jurisdictional issues are resolved, because when will that be, and how many people's lives will have been changed because their needs weren't met in the meantime? That's why we've explored this jurisdiction sharing approach, to try to see if there's a way to respect the differences the parties have regarding jurisdiction, agree that any MOU isn't going to affect those positions that they've taken, the fact that a party has entered into an MOU can't be used to argue that a party has made any concession regarding their jurisdictional position, so that they can maintain the integrity of their jurisdictional positions. But by sharing jurisdiction, try to set aside the question of who has what, and instead say, whatever we have, we're willing to share so that we can try to work together in a collaborative way. That doesn't necessarily address the issue that you raise about multiple tribes inserting claims and the state having a different claim. There are some really messy situations like that. Again, the fact that there are some really messy situations, at least in my mind, is not a reason to do nothing at all, because there are a lot of other situations where something good can happen, and so I think the challenge is to try to find out what can be done, recognizing there are some impediments. I guess the final thing is that if we do come up with a form or a model MOU and the Commission backs it, and again through a consensus process, it still takes two parties to sign it. So the state would still have to say, yes, we want to enter into an MOU with this particular entity. And if the state doesn't have sufficient confidence in one entity but does in another, they can make that judgment.
Just, Mr. Chairman, and I brought the subject up, and so I'll just let it rest, but to say that in Alaska, we want to find an Alaska solution, and if it comes down from Congress, it's going to be a tough fit.
I wasn't suggesting that would be a good idea. Thank you.
Senator Terrio.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And along the same line, we of course have had people advising the legislature to be mindful of this issue of jurisdiction. I understand the concern that the people's needs might not be met while there's this difference of opinion, but we want to be careful that we don't piecemeal take us to a policy decision that the citizens of Alaska, through their elected officials, never intended. And I guess, again, I understand wanting to meet the needs of the people while this issue hangs out there. However, if we make it easy for the U.S. Congress to avoid clarifying the situation that they have forced us into, they'll take the easy route. It's a tough issue, and they prefer not to deal with it. And I think they need to deal with it, personally.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
it's a worthwhile topic. I think it's worth exploring.
Next slide.
I appreciate the questions in the dialogue.
Next recommendation deals with expanding use of new technologies, and this is, I think, good timing on this, and Senator Stevens is Chair of Commerce, and the Telecommunications Act is up for reauthorization. Currently, there is, a pretty sophisticated telehealth system right now in place in rural Alaska that was created through the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, where we have T1 lines to all the village health clinics out there. The problem with the Telecommunications Act is that other providers, folks like, you know, the regional nonprofits that don't do health, you know, the state and others are not able to access that system. And we very much would like to see the Telecommunications Act amended so that we could get access to those systems and get access to that subsidized connectivity. And so that's a recommendation coming out of the commission. Also, a recommendation exploring more use of electronic monitoring, and then also a recommendation that the ABC board develop a statewide database that can track volume shipments to the bush. There is no tracking right now, so conceivably you could have an individual going from, you know, 16 different liquor stores in Anchorage and having alcohol shipped to Unicleet, which is a wet community in the midst of all our dry communities in the Bering Straits region, and there's no way to track that right now. So there's a suggestion that that would be a positive thing to do.
Chair Emrys.
Thank you. Can we stop there for a second? I'm a licensee, an on-premise licensee.
No, we're just taking a question.
I know package licensees that over the last decade that ship large volumes of liquor to damp and wet communities, mm-hmm. and it looks like you might as well be sending explosives or something through. I mean, it's such a tremendous volume. It's mm-hmm. And I've talked to other licensees about it, and we just cringe at seeing it because the volume is sometimes just staggering. It puts Mary Kay to shame, you know, insofar as the volume of material. Could you elaborate a little bit on that element and what we may do? Because I understand alcohol issues especially well, and I'm quite sensitive to, you know, Chief Isaac, I think, from Eagle. I wrote a letter to the ABC board on his behalf because people were. He was in a damp community, and people would ride their snow machine 15 miles, and they would be intoxicated, fall off their snow machine, and freeze to death to or from the village. And we tried to work with this particular package store not far from that area, and we were really quite hampered by the statutes that are presently on the books, and that was a close proximity issue. It was only, you know, it was a snow machine ride to get it. Can you just elaborate a little bit on how we might develop a statewide database or to work on having some better controls about that, please? Because it's so incendiary. The
can we turn to Bruce on this one?
Okay.
One of the effects of all being sort of volunteers, there are different things that we know about and different things that different commission members have focused on. So,
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bruce Patello. This is part of perhaps a more comprehensive approach that we've talked about. We've already talked about the central distribution as one strategy. The commission has explored the idea of, and I should note that there is the issue primarily of cost, but setting up a tracking system which any package store making sales would just electronically record into a central database managed by the ABC board that would indicate a sale to both destination and who the purchaser is. Would also, in the concept discussed, create a flag for other merchants if, again, in Ms. Bullard's situation or her description, someone deciding to go down the block make yet another discrete purchase, which on its own would not necessarily trigger an alarm, but would cumulatively demonstrate that there was an effort to market either into a community that was damp or dry, and also, again, be able to track who are the people, where are the destinations, what is the volume that's going on. And again, I don't think it allows us to draw at this stage the final consequences of that information, but we recognize right now we don't have it. And I think that was the primary direction of those discussions.
If I may, just to follow up on an ancillary issue, right before we convened down here in January, I was approached at my establishment by the operations director for Warbelow's Air, and General, one of your colleagues was very helpful on this matter. But he was operations director for Warbelow's Air, and he told me, he said, "Come here," he said, "We are the largest drug trafficker in the state of Alaska," which is a unique, admission from somebody. And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" And he said, "Well, I've got friends at airport police that have a drug dog. I brought him in to sniff all the shipments that we have going out to the villages, because Warbelow is a regional hub commuter airline out of Fairbanks." And he says, "We take drugs out to the villages, and then we medevac people back in." And he brought airport police in with the drug dog. They were able to sniff out three different sets of packages, and the airport police said, "Well, all three of these packages have drugs." He said, "Well, what can you do about it?" "Well, we can't do anything without a warrant." "Well, let's get a warrant." "Well, we can't do anything without the only person who can issue a warrant on this is a postal inspector, and we don't have one in Fairbanks, so there's nothing we can do." And this drug packages just go right through, and then when there are overdoses, then Warbelow's gets called out there to medevac back the rural residents who have abused. I did contact Commissioner Monaghan, and he was very responsive and was going to have one of his captains or detectives look into it and follow up right away. But I did want to get that on the record, that it's not just large volumes of alcohol, but it's our inability to do interdiction of drugs when we know that they're there and that they're going out. And we get kids to stop shooting each other when we don't let them have guns, and we would do better not to let illegal drugs and large volumes of alcohol that are clearly a part of a network marketing program and not, the legal, distribution of alcohol through a licensee, transpire. And there's a lot of goofy stuff that goes on, right from Fairbanks that I've seen over the years before and since I've been in the legislature as it relates to alcohol and drugs. And the more that you limit it on its way into those communities, the fewer problems that you'll have on the previous slides 1 through 8 that I read in when trying to catch up for my absence. So I wanted to at least bring that to your attention, and would be delighted to see some kind of a memo from Rural Justice as it relates to an approach that we could take specifically with the drug interdiction, and trying to address this gap in having a postal inspector who can serve a warrant so that we can interdict these drugs before they get on the commuter planes and head out to these villages. And then because that will allow me, General, to and commission members to, to have more of an ongoing dialogue with the Department of Public Safety, under whose jurisdiction this falls under. But it's a shame when I see a community like Fairbanks to be a hub for drug sales, and it's so clear, not to me but to my friend at Warbelow's, but he has a lot of credibility with me, so I wanted to bring that to your attention. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, the Commission appreciates your remarks. We have discussed this very issue both in terms of the inspection, the search, the degree, particularly looking at regional carriers, many of whom wish to cooperate. We recognize, however, as we have tabled these issues, that is, put them on the table for examination, that there are constitutional issues, search and seizure. I believe Senator Huggins earlier was reflecting also the state's position on right to privacy and that balance in looking at the analogy between alcohol abuse and marijuana abuse, that is, in the privacy of one's home. Where are those lines? And that has been something we as a commission have been looking at. We are trying to find that balance as well, even as we've come to particularly appreciate truly the life and death struggle that alcohol abuse is inflicting on our entire state and within our charge, rural Alaska. So this is a very, I think, appropriate comment to us.
Not to interrupt you, but just let me just put on the record that Warbelow's heir is an exemplary citizen, and they brought this to my attention with the hope of fixing it, that they're really quite a remarkable organization. I didn't want to disparage their reputation in telling that story.
I just wanted to explain also that Commissioner Tandesky, when he served on the commission, was working on that as an issue, trying to get the Alaska State Troopers cross-deputized by the post office to basically serve as postal inspectors so that they could address those kinds of issues.
Just pardon me, would it be helpful then for the legislature through a resolution to ask for some specific language to expedite that process, because it was airport police that sniffed out the three drug packages in this air commuter shipment and said there's nothing that we can do, but we know that there's drugs in bundle A, B, and C. Would that be helpful? And if so, is that some language that you could present to us so that we could try and make some forward progress on this issue, which seems germane to the
Mr. Chairman, if it would be appropriate, we have a full commission meeting taking place tomorrow, and if we might be allowed to reflect on this recommendation and perhaps communicate formally back to the Judiciary Committee's our view on the suggestion.
And just so you know, Chairman Remres, one of the earlier slides you may have stepped out, there was an effort that's already underway to cross-train.
Saw that. Thank you.
I mean, while you're doing that, keep in mind that that's recommendation number 8 is to give state troopers the authority to search packages shipped through the U.S. Postal Service. And so we'd be delighted to, Chair Emerson and I would be delighted to take a look at concrete proposal to enact that. Representative Coggin.
Just have to express also a heightened paranoia, if you will.
No, that's too tough.
Awareness.
If you can start tracking people's purchases for discovery and personal charges for damp and dry areas, it won't be long before you can do that for other things, too. And I think that also has a huge constitutional question looming over it. I'm paranoid.
it's not unlike the meth lab ingredients and the idea of having statewide registration. I think you've had probably a similar discussion in the past on that.
I agree. And if that's what it was, if people understand what when they are adding up, they only get so many gallons per purchase, it's a whole new wrinkle in alcohol management.
A discussion. Certainly those of us in Nome have observed now that we're getting kind of direct commuter service from Fairbanks, that it's real interesting who's now taking the plane from Fairbanks to Nome, for example, that which you would normally anticipate would take Alaska Airlines, but you don't get searched on Frontier going into Nome, so it's kind of interesting. And now I'll turn it over to our Attorney General to
If I might, I'd like to introduce Mr. Wilson Justin, who's also on our commission, the tribal representative. Raise your hand. He's joined us since we started. The What we were looking for, in part of seeking federal funding, not only for some of the programs that we'd be suggesting, but for the actual continuing existence of this commission and state funding as well, is ways to make these ideas viable, useful. There are also proposed changes to Title IV on the definition of manufacture and expand the forfeiture, ban written order sales to dry towns, ban shipping plastic by air, which we've kind of reviewed before as proposals to try to step into the interdiction side of the alcohol, especially being transported. We are looking at requiring hub communities to have, we've kind of discussed part of this before, alcohol distribution sites to centralize a way to watch over what's being sent to who, and having a central hub obviously would make that an easier process to follow through with. Allowing Division of Juvenile Justice to delegate authority to tribes. Again, we're not unmindful of Representative Coghill or Senator Terrio's concerns, and the state is in no rush to surrender rights. And certainly there is a possibility of a tangle being created by creating makeshift mechanisms to try to address the needs that are there currently and avoid the battles. But at the same time, there are needs that we are looking to try to address, and there should be a way to try to approach both issues and not neglect one in the meantime. Permitting tribes to participate in juvenile sentencing and treatment is something that, to the degree it's in place, has shown some real hope in the meantime. Allowing relatives to take foster children at a standard rate is to try to, address the disproportionate per capita problems that are in villages and to try to make it fair and somewhat, again, standard across the state. Involving tribes and allowing flexibility in foster home licensing is again, going to be touching on those same jurisdictional issues. And again, the Attorney General's office is not unmindful of things like regulation and standardization of regulation and the idea of who is going to be liable and who is going to be responsible and who wants to surrender what type of sovereignty in exchange for assistance. Those aren't easy to answer, and that's why we are still working on the Child Welfare Act Memorandum of Understanding, because while there are questions we think we can find ways to address, they are not easy to address, and this commission has been in place for several years, and we hope to have time and money to continue to a conclusion, which we think there has been real positive steps made to trying to address these things. We are caught in the midst of the changing attitude in Congress about earmarks right now. There's a request to Congress to extend the life of the Alaska Rural Justice and Law Enforcement Commission. There's an earmark that's kind of in limbo. This commission is, in theory, out of funds within a month. We know you're not the proper direct committee to go to for funding, but we would be looking at least for stopgap funding from the state for $50,000, which I think a request had been put in place earlier to at least keep it going, depending on what happens with other funding sources being able to supplement or continue it. But we're very close to making some substantive contributions to addressing the four underlying issues that the commission was set up to address, and it would be a shame to have it expire for lack of access to an earmark that actually is apparently there, but we're not sure how to get it. And so we want to continue the dialogue with the stakeholders, explore recommendations on development, and to monitor the success of the programs that have been put into place. And that concludes our formal presentation. Thank you for your time and your interest.
Thank you, General. On that last point, are you in the supplemental budget, or are you seeking help in the supplemental budget?
We are not in it. We are seeking it. We apparently, the commission was too late to get into the supplemental budget, as I understand it. I'm just shifting in. Mr. Torgerson might be able to verify that, but I think I
understand. I understand we're not in the supplemental budget either, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Chair Emmers.
Thank you. General, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but were the, as a member of the administration in trying to identify $150 million in cuts, would you recommend that the Rural Justice Program be one of those programs that should be cut?
No, I have not recommended that, and I did not recommend that. And I think in the context of the Department of Law and the roughly $4 million that are involved in our portion of that discussion, this was not one of the recommended cuts.
Sorry, Chair, Senator Huggins.
And in fact, there was nothing to cut on this because it's a federally funded program. I'm guessing you're anticipating if we got the $50,000, would I recommend that come in? No.
In a positive sense, Mr. Chair, my recommendation is we get the support of the governor and public safety or wherever the administration feels appropriate and put it as a line item and as a point of departure.
Representative Cockhill.
I've appreciated some of the work and obviously consensus in some of the tribal issues to me are going to be tough to get to, but I still think the dialogue has to happen. So, I mean, I think we're going to have to talk about these things because that's the real world we live in. However, the feds have funded it at what level up to this point? Because I think as we go up to our finance people, we might want to be looking at what goes beyond $50,000.
It's been $272,000 annually via the earmark from the federal government for the last two years.
Senator Theriault.
And what you're asking for consideration on now is stopgap funding.
Stopgap.
Not that the states step in with a standard ongoing line item.
No, it would be a fraction of our traditional budget.
Mr. Chairman, I've been sitting on the committee where for every dollar that you're talking about, we're talking about $100 million, you know, in the health and social service budget. And the feds have been devolving a lot of the things that go on in Alaska that they have been, you know, funding, have been just changing their funding sources. And the want is for us to pick up as much as we can. But I can tell you, just this morning, we were talking somewhere, I can't remember the figure, Ms. Holmes may be able to help me, but it was a significant amount of money that is going to be left for us where we're going to have to go to the very services that you're asking that we have in Alaska with children care, with foster care, with all these things. It was up in the $30, $40 million range that is just not going to be there anymore. And they have to do with our direct grants coming from the state. That's not even counting the grants that go right over us. We never even see in Juneau and land in the various different communities all over Alaska. So the dialogue that we need to have is important. But the world that we're living in is a little different as far as the receding capacity from the feds. And what I'm saying, my point of the telling is the need for the commission may end up falling wholly on Alaska at that point.
I can see that.
So I just we got to be careful what we recommend to our finance committees, but I can see that would be the case. And the work product to date has created a very good dialogue within Alaska, so I would hate to see that diminish. We have not arrived at that many conclusions either.
Questions or comments from other members of the committee? I have just one. I know Senator Huggins and Senator and Representative Cockhill have raised some interesting constitutional questions today, and one of your recommendations jumped out at me along the same lines. Maybe I could just, for the
purposes of discussion raise it. Recommendation number 17 asks that we ban written order sales to residents of dry communities. Statement of need says that presently residents of dry communities can take delivery of alcohol in areas where it's legal to receive alcohol, damp communities, and then they turn around and bring that alcohol back to the dry community. Maybe you could, I mean, this is a, it's sort of a common sense idea, but I guess what I see you making up is a list of human beings that live in a dry community and then preventing them from leaving that dry community to buy alcohol someplace else. I mean, that just seems to me like a very, very thorny issue. And maybe some of you that have thought about it can describe your thinking on that. And I see all eyes are turning to the former Attorney General, Mr. Battella.
Wants to duck or disappear.
You're saying you're looking at your watch saying, my goodness, how late it is.
Mr. Chairman, I think you've hit the nub of the issue. And I think, again, Senator Huggins, Representative Coghill have both identified, I think, our fundamental challenge in even formulating a recommendation to the legislature or to Congress is trying to balance individual rights to privacy or other rights against any measure we ultimately bring to you. We do not have a legislative package that addresses that question, in part because I don't think we really feel comfortable yet that we have an approach that we can say pass constitutional muster. And the Attorney General has not commented here, but he has been very clear that he will independently scrutinize these issues in terms of the state's interest and his duty to make sure that we're not forwarding laws that are going to provide fodder for either federal or state constitutional deficiencies. And so we're struggling with it. It's not a direct answer other than to say, Mr. Chairman, that we know that we have several suggestions here that come close to the line or may cross the line. And before we have any legislation to offer you on those points, you can be assured that we will have looked at those issues very carefully and we'll have sufficient constitutional underpinning before you have to deal with them.
I see that the proposal comes with a citation to a Senate bill that was introduced back in 2003. I don't recall the bill, but I'll take a look at it. I'm just curious. I think it's one of those common sense ideas that I think that runs smack into the brick wall of the Constitution. Other questions, comments? Representative Coghill.
Comment on the telecommunication thing. A lot of work's gone into it. I got to see one of the first ones operate out of Selawik, and that was on it was our first hookup for telemedicine. Excellent. But it's also true that those are available only to natives in those communities. And so the crossover between connections, I appreciate you bringing up, because I know that there are agreements to serve, but it doesn't work real well under some funding sources. So and of course, the question comes to my mind because I was raised in a smaller kind of a rural town. I mean, it was on the road system, so it wasn't totally out of. But the fact that just because you live in rural Alaska means you're going to be a native just doesn't hold up. Now it's probably the vast majority, but I know where services are being delivered that people who live in a rural area just don't have access to those services because they're not native. And a lot of that is through the health clinics and through some of the telemedicine issues. And so it's another sticky issue that we're going to have to deal with. Now, some villages fudge, but when it comes time for auditing, the fudge is taken away. So it's just a tough issue.
Currently, under the Telecommunications Act, hospitals and clinics, libraries, and schools are eligible for those subsidized rates. That's what's currently subsidized in rural Alaska in terms of connectivity. And so, for example, Clerk, we're not, because we're not a health, but we do Head Start, we do Village Police, we do education, we do counseling, we do, you know, child welfare, we do a whole range of issues, but we're not able to get those subsidies. So, for example, and we'd very much like to be able to do, like, video counseling, you know, meetings. I mean, it could just be huge in terms of bringing economic benefits to the bush. But for a T1 line in the Bering Straits region, it costs $12,000 a month per site. That same expense in Anchorage is like $800 a month. With those subsidies from the USAC, it's like $150 a month for T1 lines to the villages. And that's the kind of subsidies, certainly we're suggesting changes to Senator Stevens that would make the rural service providers in those areas of the nation without terrestrial landlines, which is code for Alaska, that we'd be eligible for those subsidies. The other thing that we're recommending is that they provide the opportunity for competition, because right now we're stuck with these $12,000 to $14,000 a month T1 line charges, where we think if we had more competition that those amounts would come down. And so those are just some of the issues associated with that. In terms of services to non-natives, I mean, CLERC and all of our contracts with the state, it's a requirement that we provide services to non-natives, and we do that. Our federal dollars that we receive because of our status of as Native Americans, it says that we will use those dollars to provide services to Native Americans. But, for example, our adult basic education programs, our VIPSO, our Head Start dollars, all of our service dollars that we receive via the state, we provide services to non-natives also.
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't be getting to that, but there are places where, especially in the health dollars, where it just gets narrowed down. And it gets tough in a town. It actually inflames a lot of people. So it's just one of those things, you know, that, and I'm not saying it to be antagonist. The antagonism goes on in the town. So we just, you know, it's part of the discussion, that's all.
I think that there is an opportunity for, you know, certainly the health corporations and those individuals that want services through those vehicles to work together to come to some sort of agreement about those services.
Sure. And then my suggestion, whenever we talk about these issues within our own state budget, is to make sure that we focus on whatever flexibility we can get. And as federal money recedes and we're going to backfill, those kind of discussions are going to be continuing discussions.
And just to use as another example, for in Nome, we have Norton Sound Regional Hospital, which is owned by the Native people. The Bering Straits region provides services to Natives and non-Natives. Third-party revenue is a big part of their budget, and I mean, there's not a problem with people being turned away at the door. So,
we have time for one more question from Senator Huggins.
Just as a comment, I remember maybe 4 or 5 years ago, my youngest son and I were on a hunting trip. We spent a couple, 3 days in New Stoyahawk. And the Marine Corps reserves had gone out there and built a little shed where the local community got out of the weather while they're waiting on airplanes. But my son and I had a couple, 3 days to sit there in bad weather and talk about, well, we're trying to protect our Super Cubs sitting outside, talking about all those stories that the writings on those new walls, and it goes right down the lines of a lot of your findings. When I read that the other day, that was sort of the thing I reflected on. It didn't matter what was grain alcohol on one margin or sex on the other margin, it was about the story that your findings reflect on. It's very interesting.
Thank you, Senator Huggins. With nothing else to come before the committee, I want to thank you all for being here today. It was a very informative and, I think, lively presentation. I appreciate your effort in the service of Alaskans. We're adjourned.
Thank you.